Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Captain Hunter's Podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. I truly appreciate you guys listening in, tuning in, downloading the podcast, telling your friends and all that kind of stuff. So thank you. For some time now, I've been following a blog called Improving Police. The blog is run by a former chief of police, David C. Cooper, C-O-U-P-E-R. That's how you spell his last name. David C. C-O-U-P-E-R. The name of his blog is Improving Police. His blog can be reached at improvingpolice.wordpress.com. So that's where his blog is at. So for some time now, I had been thinking about militarization of the police, and I was doing some research about it and about to put together an episode for a podcast that's going to be coming up. So I read over one of his blogs, and one of his recent blogs is Why Militarizing Police is a Very Bad Idea. And so because I saw his blog and the thoughts and had come through my mind that I was going to do an episode of Militarizing Police, let me get this former chief of police opinion on, and so let me contact him. So I reached out to him, and he was very gracious enough to be a guest on my show. Today's episode is going to be an interview with former chief of police David C. Cooper from Minnesota. Now let me just give you a little bit of his bio. In the episode, you will hear me ask him to tell us about himself. He's very humble, as you can compare what I'm going to read to you from his bio that I found online as compared to what he told us in today's episode. He's going to talk a little bit about his wife. He's actually married to a retired captain from the State Capitol Police in Minnesota. Maybe I'll have to have her on when I try to do an episode about female law enforcement. Let's just look at what he's doing today. He was in the U.S. Marines from 1956 to 1960. He served in reserve duty from 62 to 68. He was a police officer in the city of Edna, Minnesota from 1960 to 1962. He was a graduate teaching assistant at University of Minnesota, Department of Sociology from 68 to 71. He was a detective, police trainer, and police officer in the city of Minneapolis from 62 to 69. He was the director of public safety for the city of Burnsville, Minnesota from 69 to 72. He was the chief of police from the city of Madison from 72 to 1993 when he finally retired. He then left that line of policing, still continue on the same path as far as ministry, as far as helping his fellow man. He became a resident chaplain, married to a hospital in Madison from 94 to 95. He was a priest in charge of St. John the Baptist Episcopal Church from Portage, Wisconsin, December 95 to 2000. Priest in charge, he was a lecturer in criminal justice, University of Wisconsin at Platteville and from 16 to 2018. Priest in charge of St. Peter's Episcopal Church, North Lake, Wisconsin from 2005 until the present. His education, he's got his MA from religious studies. He's got certificate in Anglican studies. He's got an MA in sociology, criminology, and deviant behavior. Got his BA in Russian language in 1968. He's published a number of articles, Quality Leadership, the First Step Towards Quality Policing, that was in Police Chiefs Magazine, 1987. Police Department Learns 10 Hard Lessons, Quality Progress Magazine, that was published in 1990. Quality Policing Madison Experience with Sabine Lobotz, that's his wife, Sabine Lobotz, Police Executive Research Forum, 1991. Effective Community-Oriented Policing, Vision, Leadership, and the Problem-Solving Method with his wife, again, Sabine Lobotz, Police Chief Magazine, 1991. Forgiveness in the Community, Views from an Episcopal Priest and Former Chief of Police in Exploring Forgiveness. That was in University of Wisconsin Press. He's got a book, How to Relate to Your Local Police, 1983 to 2015, the Quality of Leadership textbook. He also has a book which he talks about in the podcast, Arrested Development, a Veteran Police Chief Sounds Off About Protests, Racism, and Corruption, and the 7 Steps Necessary to Improve Our Nation's Police. That was published 2012. He then republished it, did a re-editing version in 2017. Restoration Point, he's got a book of poetry, 2011, and Telling It Like It Is, Cooper on Cops, 2017. Some of his interests, running, biking, skiing, travel, martial arts, and poetry. So this man has done a lot as far as ministry, done a lot as far as police work, academics, speaks Russian, or at least he did. This is the high quality guest that I'm trying to bring you guys. So I appreciate all that David C. Cooper has done for his city, for the state, for his time and service. Today we're going to get into a little bit of interviewing. So once again, I wanted to really kind of gear this towards militarizing the police because of the article that he wrote on his blog, which was called Why Militarizing Police is a Very Bad Idea. As I scrolled through his former articles, he's written a number of other blogs concerning this idea. In 2013, he published a blog called More on Militarization. In 2014, he wrote another blog, Another Voice Against Police Militarization. In 2014, he wrote another blog. So he's got about four blogs on more on the militarization of police. Blog is still up and active. He claims that he's not as active as he was, but he's got about 1,400 subscribers to the blog already. He's been a lecturer in colleges and everything like that. So we got a good episode for you today. Once again, I want to gear just towards police militarization. However, we talked about a number of other things. Police PTSD, talked about suicide. We talked about just where law enforcement is going. So it's a really good interview, and I really think you guys are really going to enjoy this. This is a veteran police chief, 20 plus years, 30 years in law enforcement, 20 plus years. Was revolutionary in his time when he was in the 60s and 70s, trying to bring more women onto the police department, trying to incorporate more African-American officers and just people of color, and try to make his department more reflective of the community that they were representing. So he's got a lot of ideas about school, about how they used to police the schools back in the days as in comparison to what they're doing now. A really good interview. I really hope you guys listen to it. I really hope you guys take something away from it. Enough of me blabbing on. Here's the interview with former police chief David C. Cooper.
Okay. Okay. Website there, you try to train people to be smart on tests and interviews, huh?
So I started a business helping people take promotional tests. I'm going to be expanding it into helping people become police officers, personal training, things like that. So I'm looking to expand that business and just kind of doing this podcast.
Amazing. I know, thinking back, you know, years ago, still the level of preparation was so poor. People didn't know how to do interviews. They didn't know how to put together a resume. They didn't know how to present themselves. They didn't even know how to dress sometimes.
Well, exactly, and we've run into that. As a matter of fact, from our department, we started our own academy, and so we were actually telling people, listen, do this, do that, do this, do that, come dressed like this.
Sure.
So we certainly had that problem. And my wife works for a company, it was formerly called the YWCA, it's like Women and Children's Family Center now or something like that. So she helps people get back on their feet, do job interviews, go back to school, things like that. And so she's run into that problem tremendously, where people just come in, you know, rip shirt and jeans for job interviews and stuff. So she has to tell people. So there's this whole skill set that's being lost. So I figured I'd do something to help out with that.
No, it sounds like something that's really needed.
Yeah. Just getting it up and running. I just retired back in February, so I'm just kind of getting my feet wet in this whole thing. You yourself were a former chief, is that right?
Yeah, 25 years.
Okay.
Before your career.
Yeah. So I certainly thank you for being on the podcast. Certainly appreciate it. I came across your blog, I'm not sure how long ago, but a few months ago, maybe even last year, when I was preparing to kind of get my business up and running. And I saw your blog. I am subscribed to it. So I'm very impressed with what you're doing and what you're trying to do in your efforts and everything like that.
Yeah. I really scaled back a lot. About a year ago, but I still can't help but see issues that pop up and comment on them. And I was probably, blog was probably most active probably, you know, during and after Ferguson. So it was really, really, a mismatch out there. I mean, you know, sometimes we just don't get it.
Yeah, and that's a terrible shame. And so that whole Ferguson thing, that's been kind of a marker in law enforcement. We had a guy, forgive me, I can't think of his name right now, but he goes all around the country, and he was actually one of the people that were brought in to help with the whole Ferguson situation post the riots and all that, to try to reform their police department. I almost thought of his name. I'll think of it as the interview goes along. But anyway, he's a really good attorney. He's out of Connecticut, Southington, Connecticut. He actually has a virtual type of office, at least that's what he calls it. He has no physical building. He just goes all around to different police departments and helps with their consent decrees and everything like that. So he came in and talked with us about, you know, what he did in Ferguson and just about all these consent decrees, and just talked to us about a number of different issues. So that whole Ferguson thing was certainly a watershed moment in law enforcement.
A lot of good and bad images, of course, are the iconic negative image that's out there is, of course, the St. Louis County SWAT team coming in with, you know, officers on top of the MRAP with bipod weapons pointed at the crowd, you know. That's probably the most negative image that I take away from there. I think the most positive was the one captain who came in from outside and just went out and talked to the protesters in front of the police station, just interacted with them, and I think reduced a lot of tension and was a good de-escalator there. It escapes me now, but I think I highlighted him on my blog a few years ago. So yeah, I think a lot of things blew from that. But Black Lives Matter certainly came forth, and for some reason that Black Lives Matter has been the tension among police, which I have great difficulty in understanding at this point in my life. I mean, Blue Lives Matter. Well, yeah, they really do. Have you ever seen a situation where blue life didn't matter? I mean, let's think about officer fatalities around the country, the whole community, sometimes the whole nation turns out. Blue lives really do matter. But yeah, when you compare that with black lives, how does that position itself?
Right.
I think the point of Black Lives Matter is that they haven't mattered much before, so let's make them matter now. And I think that's a goal that we should all work for. Why are we contentious about that?
So where do you think that contention comes from? And by the way, I do agree. I was very disappointed with Facebook, you see so much. And so I was very disappointed when I saw a member of my own department put on there Blue Lives Matter, Blue Lives Matter, this, that, and the other. So why do you think there is a contention when someone simply says Black Lives Matter?
For the most part, white America doesn't get it. And for the most part, police don't get it, who are predominantly people of privilege because of our race and the color of skin, and we just really don't understand that. And that's why I have pressed so much over the years that the importance of developing empathy within policing. You've got to be able to, and it isn't easy, and all cops can't do it, and if they can't do it, they shouldn't be cops. And that is, you've got to understand what it's like to walk in the other person's shoes. And of course you can say you can be overly empathic so much you can't function. Yeah, that's true. That does happen. But for the most part, that's not the problem. The problem is the lack of empathy and the lack of compassion. And I believe strongly in compassionate policing. I think that that's such an important factor, as do the emotional intelligence of the people that we hire. But to be compassionate, there is a lot easier than being sort of the tough kid on the block, the sort of warrior concept that we've seen from our colleagues for so many years. It just doesn't work, I think in the long run, people say that, officer, I'll be respectful for people when they're first respectful to me. And I said, well, wait a second, you're the guy with the gun, you're the guy with the power, wouldn't it be nice if you were the first person to be respectful even to people who aren't respectful to you? And you and I know that. I mean, we've been on the street. We know that, somebody gets all cranked up and everything. We come on, we get cranked up, and we go right up to their level. There's going to be a bad outcome, and generally we'll win. We'll get the guy arrested and thrown in jail. But also, we know that the state could take a step back and say, hey, man, let's not go there. Let's just talk about this.
Right.
Let's sit down and talk about this. Come on.
Right.
You don't want to get in jail. I don't want to take you to jail. Let's try to take this thing apart and get things fixed. Because we police have such an advantage of doing good in this society. It's overwhelming. I mean, we are the constitutional officers. We're the ones that practice what that parchment in Washington says. I mean, we're the guys and gals that do it.
Right. You're absolutely right. And that's one thing I always stress when I was a supervisor is, treat people the way that you would want them to treat your aunt, your mother, your sister. And because I could not stand getting complaints about people, about officers swearing at people, about being mean. And that bothers me above complaints of this officer stole my money, which we didn't get much of that. But just when somebody comes in and says, listen, I don't mind that the officer towed my car, but did he have to swear at me? Did he have to cuss at me? My children in the car, they're witnessing this. And that bothered me more than anything else. It really, really did.
And you probably heard this too. I think this is it was like my first month on the job. I just got out of the Marines, got a job in the suburb of Minneapolis, worked there for a couple of years, and it was the best education I got because I worked in a wealthy suburb of Minneapolis. All right?
Mm-hmm.
And guess what? You know, the expectation of the chief or the supervisor of the department is that, you know, we're here to serve, and quite frankly, those rich people are not going to take a lot of shit from us.
Yeah.
And if you want to work here, you learn to be nice. And I remember this old timer, he was getting ready to retire, and he said, Cooper, he said, you give a ticket, you just give a ticket and keep your mouth shut. And if you're mad at somebody, chew them out, but don't you ever, ever chew them out and give them the ticket.
Right. It's either or. Right. It's either or.
That's
yeah.
Right. That's right. We, you know, learn those kinds of things.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, what I worry about today is what I see is a certain attitude. I mean, it's that attitude that maybe some of us had at one time. You know, we got a little cocky. We're thinking, you know, we're really, really important people, and people need to respect us. And we get a little cocky, and pretty soon realize that, well, that doesn't work very well. I'm not getting the outcomes I want here.
Right.
And there's better ways to handle this. So, but what I see today is, you know, a lot of 5 to 10 year, you know, maybe even 15 year veterans that are just, they're jaded, they're angry, what they're doing doesn't seem to work, and they're not happy people.
Right.
And I keep on, you know, you probably said this too. I said, look, I tell this to a young man or woman, you know, wanting to come in the police department, or maybe in their recruit school training. I said, you know, ladies and gentlemen, this is the best job you'll ever have. You know, this is a wonderful job. You can really be one of those superheroes that you used to read about in those dull comic books.
Right.
You can go out and protect people. You can help people that have no one else in the whole city is going to protect them. Everyone thinks they're crap. You have a chance to come in there and be decent and fair.
Right.
And it's a great job. So don't screw it up.
Yeah, and I think that sentiment is lost. When I remember when I came on, we heard things like that as well. And I'm not sure if that same message is being, it may be being said, but it's certainly not being embraced by this younger generation. So, you know, these guys are staying cops for 2, 3, 4, 5 years, and they're either going to other departments or they're just changing careers altogether. So there's a certain pride that is certainly gone from law enforcement.
You know, that's the whole thing, and we haven't talked about it yet, but about this business, about militarization.
Right.
And it, you know, it starts, I've seen, you know, when we first put officers in the schools, this is in the 1960s, you know, the officer, you work in the schools, you know, sharp officer, you like to work with kids and everything, we're going to put a blazer on you. You carry your weapon, you carry your handcuffs, you have a little blazer, you have a nice little police department patch on your lapel and your name there, okay?
Right.
And you're going to be part of the teaching staff here. And your job is, the reason we're putting you in the school is to keep kids out of the criminal justice system, because once they get in there, they get lost.
Right.
So let's try and do that. And that was an outpouring from the 1967 President's Commission report on policing, which recommended that there be youth service bureaus in order to deter kids from getting into the system, because once they get in there, they're lost. And we certainly have seen that over the years.
Yes, we have.
Now all of a sudden, you know, I look to the school that 20 years ago we had officers with blazers in. My gosh, they look like they're SWAT team people.
Yeah.
They got some outside body armor. They got police in 6-inch sweaters. They got BDU's battle dress uniform, boots, and pocketed. I mean, they look like they're ready to go to war. They got extra visible clips where they're carrying on their little vest there. And I say, what is that? What is that? And it kind of reminds me, you know, to my training when I was at the university in sociology, is that, you know, this is all about, you know, how you want to present yourself. It's the presentation of self. And the presentation of self goes to your job interview. How do you want people to perceive you when you go in there and you're going to apply for a job for a police officer? How are you going to dress? And the other thing is that how do people perceive you as a police officer out in the street now when you've got all this warrior, militarized equipment that you're wearing? And I don't think it's that's essential for the job. And then we look at, you know, what's going on with SWAT teams. From that study was done in Maryland, is that, you know, 97% of SWAT team assignments are basically doing for reward service. You know, that's not what it was designed for.
Right.
And then when we take a look at some of the outcomes, about 70 or 80% of these encounters involve the breaching of a door and the taking of property.
Right.
How is that going to come across? And, you know, maybe things have changed today, but I remember whenever we broke a door or a window or something, it was an awful long time before that person ever got any remuneration for that. It went through claims in the city legal department, and it just took forever. And for people who are, you know, subsisting one paycheck to another, there isn't any money around to fix that door.
Right.
We're probably talking a couple $100 there, if anything.
Right.
And, you know, and that's part of the empathy, about being compassionate. You know, when you got a single mom with a couple of kids in the car who maybe slid through a stop sign or something, you know, did you really want to give her a ticket that's going to range with all of its extra taxations and things, $200 to $300?
Exactly.
Do we really want to do that?
Yeah.
Is there some other thing we can do? And we've done all this traffic enforcement stuff. We put on all these surcharges and stuff so that you know, it isn't a minor thing. It's a major economic event in a person's life, especially a person who's going paycheck to paycheck. Got a ticket.
Exactly. Yeah. I completely agree. And I always struggled with that when I was a patrolman, giving out those $200, $300, $400 tickets. In fact, I tried to always minimize it. I mean, I was always called soft or whatever because I felt that way. But as you mentioned, you got one kid who's in a car seat, another kid who's maybe getting to that age where he's not in a car seat, and guys just want to whack him, and the mother maybe doesn't have insurance, which is all, you know, we understand that it's legally wrong. But there's a moral principle concept to this too. She's a single mom working maybe two jobs, and she's bringing her kid to her mother's house, to her grandparents' house, in order to get to the next job. And you're going to give this person $200-$300 ticket, you know. And then she may have to take off from work to go to court. And this is—I always thought that was just a cruel way of doing business. Yeah.
So we've had a couple incidents that have been videoed. One was at a shopping center involving two officers, white officers, arresting a African-American teenager girl who was a little bit out of control. She's like taken down to the pavement and handcuffed, and they put a spit bag over her head, and it was just like, you know, what in the world is going on here? I mean, isn't there other ways we could have done this? And of course, the city attorney, of course, said this is legal within the officer's use of force. She said, you know, consistent with our training and that. And then we just had another one of few weeks ago involving, you know, a young black student who was having an emotional event at his house, and there was a security camera inside the house, you know, and he's taken down, you know, bounced around. Again, you know, what the public hears is, well, it's legal for the officers to do this from the city attorney or from the district attorney, and then we hear, you know, consistent with our training, and but our I've argued against this. I said, let's look at how this appears. Is this how you want your son or daughter? I don't want my daughter, who maybe made a mistake, who's maybe getting mouthy to police, maybe she's even shoplifted, to get bounced to the ground. I mean, I just don't think this is right. And our mayor, she said, wrote a blog. She said, I understand this is a legal use of force. I understand that this is a training and policy, but I don't think we should do this. And of course, she gets attacked by the conservatives on the city council, and she gets attacked by the police union for being judgmental. No. She's, you know, she's arguing that these kind of things, if we can prevent them from happening, it's well worth doing because they destroy trust.
Right.
And if you don't have trust, you don't have support, and the police can't do a good job in our community enough to trust and support it.
So many people simply do not understand that. And that goes back to the empathetic policing style that you mentioned, you know, and we live in such a bifurcated society where people think that this is okay. On one hand, usually it's those conservative types, the police unions and everything like that. And then you have other people who think like you and I, who say, you know, I don't want my son or daughter getting bounced off the pavement. We all mostly saw, I'm sure you did, this whole situation in Phoenix where the black couple is accosted, in my opinion, by the police officers. They're pulling guns, swearing every other word, trying to rip the babies out the kids' arm. It's traumatic to watch, and this is ridiculous. And in one of my other episodes, I mentioned that I can't believe that this would happen in, as we mentioned before, a more affluent neighborhood. You would not see this happening in an all-white community where the people's income was $200,000, and they were accused. You're not going to do that, right? So there's certainly something going on, and this goes back to what we talked about before, the whole Black Lives Matter thing. If Black Lives Matter, then that would not happen. It's just the bottom line, you would not see that kind of thing.
And I know that this continual dialogue throughout the years, I've got plenty of posts on this, is we need to look at how we're handling people with weapons, not firearms, weapons, clubs, knives, machetes, whatever. Okay, do we, in each and every one of these situations, have to take their life?
Right.
Are there other ways? And then I look at gotten some videos from the UK. There was one from Taiwan. Essentially, it was crowded neighborhood, a market, you know, people all over the place, and a man exhibiting mental illness with a machete, and he's swinging the machete around. The first thing that came was a bunch of men in white coats came running down the streets with long staffs, with a half of a hoop at the end. You know, so they would pin him to the wall with these long poles, and the guy couldn't move. He'd like swing the machete and do this. And that went on for a while. And then all of a sudden, on the side of the camera, came a whole bunch of police officers, about 10 or 12 of them. And they ran and grabbed him and dropped him down to the ground.
Right, right.
And I looked at that, and there's one in the UK where a guy's got the man of color, he's got a knife, and all white police officers run. They pick up garbage can covers, kind of like their shields, and they eventually rush him and drop him down to the ground without killing him.
Right. It can be done. I mean, it's just a matter of...
Why is it that we would not want to... I said, if you got a bunch of cops down, a bunch of senior, smart street cops, and say, hey, guys and gals, here's the problem. You just can't shoot those people with knives anymore. It just doesn't look good. It's destroying trust in the community. Okay, can you think of any other way we could do this? And I'd bet dollars to donuts that those cops would develop a system, a policy, and a training to, you know, using maybe problem-oriented policing methods, that they would come up a way in which the whole department could embrace it and say, yeah, this sounds like a good idea.
Right. I definitely believe it can be done. It's just a matter of, number one, patience, number two, training, and the willingness to do it. I mean, if you want to do it, and I'm sure that in many other circumstances, in many situations, depending upon the community that they're involved in, that it can be done. We see all these mass shooters being taken into custody. We saw Dylan Roof from the South Carolina church shooting taken into custody and brought for a cheeseburger. So it's possible if they had the patience, the willingness, the time. And we all understand that there are certain times you can't wait. Exigent circumstances arise. We get that. Obviously, if somebody's popping off rounds at the police, do what you got to do and take them out. But if they're you know, wielding a knife and kind of standing there, you know, what's wrong with pepper spraying them or bean bags or other methods in order to bring these people into custody? So it can be done.
Well, even, you know, I've got some involved in martial arts before my life, and still continue. And you take like a 6-foot bow staff and the person to a knife and say, okay, now we're gonna have a contest here. And a guy with a 6-inch bow staff doesn't have to have a lot of training, but what's gonna happen is the other guy's knee is gonna be taken out.
Right.
He's gonna drop like a rock, okay, and get him down to the hospital there. And then when his mother comes in and she says, you know, what did you do to my son? I said, well, we didn't kill him. Sorry, we took a ski out of joint, but that could be fixed. Ma'am, your son is alive.
That's the most important thing. That's the most important thing.
Here's another theory. My wife was a cop for 20 years, too. And
okay.
We talked about this, and I think the fear factor is really, really big. And I think when we get the racial perspective in here, that I think, you know, that because most white officers have little contact with people of color outside of work, it is sort of seeing black males as kind of, well, there was a book written about this back in the 60s. Jerome Skolnick wrote a book, and it was called Justice Without Trial. What he was talking about is that police officers see black males as symbolic assailants.
Okay.
That they are dangerous in and of themselves. That would add a lot. You know, this goes back to my early career. They just got out of recruit school. We were working the day shift. It was Minneapolis, downtown bank robbery. Well, a lot of those are, of course, false alarms. But being good trained officers, you know, my partner grabbed the shotgun, went to one end of the building, and I went to the other side, and another car came in, and we had to surround it, and pretty soon it was a stand down, and we were getting back into the car, and our sergeant, we just told him, hey, give me a ride back to my car. And as he got to the back seat, I saw that my partner still had the shotgun in his hand. It was still like shaking all over. And the sergeant leaned over, and he says, you really think this is the kind of job you want to have?
Right.
And, and then the next day he retired, or he resigned.
Yeah.
You know, it's a job in which, you know, you have to show some fear, or you're not a normal person. But it's how do we manage that fear?
Yes.
You know,
yes.
How do we manage those encounters? You know, how do we control our breathing? You know, have we had that kind of contact? And the one reason I like martial arts so much, it gets especially people into body contact with other people, get hands on. So when somebody grabs on to you, you don't have to go crazy. You know, it's like,
yeah.
So I just think there's a whole bunch of emotional stuff that maybe we're not seeing. And then if we have the PTSD, then that gets really scary, because I've got a couple of partners I've worked with PTSD, and fortunately one committed suicide, and the other one's still in prison. And I think back at that.
Wow.
And the emotional cost, and are we being aware of, you know, especially with NYPD, and it seems to be a outbreak of suicide. Well, there's like 30 or 40,000 officers, but still above their normal experience of suicide.
Yeah.
And what's our job as leaders to sort of monitor our men and women, to look for those telltale signs, to say, hey, you know, you need to get a little help here.
We had a number of suicides, two or three within a 3-year span, and then there was a couple other cities and towns in Connecticut that also had one or two. I mean, obviously this is a problem that goes all over. And so we brought some specialists in, and we tried to form matter of fact, we were in the middle of forming a group, you know, just to kind of a support group, just to kind of monitor that kind of thing. But I do think that that's definitely important, and it certainly is a problem. It certainly is a problem.
Start talking about it.
Yeah.
You know, what are those symptoms? I mean, what can you do? And you know, you don't have to do this. You know, you've got the people who will help you. And this peer group stuff. I mean, also, you know, the officers themselves being aware of their partners. I mean, we say we care for one another, but do we really?
Right.
Do we really care for each other?
Yeah, no, and I think that's actually a very valid point. I can remember, you know, all the funerals that we go to when somebody commits suicide or line of duty death. You know, sometimes it's just a big, unfortunately, I say this very reluctantly, but I think it's a lot of truth to it, that it's a lot of times it's just a big show of solidarity. And as you said, do we really care about each other? If we really care, then we'll do everything we can to make sure that people are mentally and emotionally well off, you know?
Yeah. So. And this whole area that the New Orleans has worked on through a son of a former officer that I worked in Minneapolis, his son was involved in peer intervention training. You know,
right.
If we really, really cared for one another, then if we saw another officer doing something that would cause him or her to lose their job, and be shamed or go to jail, shouldn't we say something?
Right.
You know?
Right.
You know, do we have this contract that with our partners we say, if you ever see me doing something that I'm going to be regretful for, or it's going to embarrass me, or cause me to lose my job, or go to jail, you know, I want you to grab hold of me. Right. I'm giving you permission to say, hey, can we back down here a little bit? Can we ratchet down a little bit here?
Right.
You know, and I watch, one thing popped to mind was I don't know, it was down in St. Louis. It was at a hospital, and this detective was trying to get this nurse to draw blood from a vehicular homicide thing. And they had a policy against that. It had to go through certain channels.
Mm-hmm.
And six or seven cops stood around and watched this detective browbeat this nurse for this, and he ended up losing his job.
You know, I think I remember that. That was a case law.
Got fired for that. So here, okay, the brotherhood, the sisterhood of officers, not one of those officers standing around said, Just step back.
That was a big case law, right? I remember hearing about that. Yeah. I remember the officer, losing his job over a drunk driving kind of thing. I remember that. Remember hearing about that.
It has to do with blood. And she said, we signed this policy with your department, and we agreed that this is the procedure. This is a procedure, and you're asking me to break this procedure. I'm not going to do this. And then he threatened to arrest her.
Yeah, I remember that. I absolutely remember that. Here we are back to this empathetic policing. And I do believe that a lot of it has to do with just the type of personalities. And unfortunately, law enforcement attracts these super alpha male type personality, either attracts them or it makes them. I'm not exactly sure which one it is. It either attracts them, so they already have these propensities, or it makes them do their training and through the academy. So I'm really struggling over which one. It may be a combination of both, but I'm not sure still what's going on here. Let's talk about a little bit of your history. I just kind of just went into this conversation. I was reading your about you. Can you just tell the audience a little bit about yourself? I mean, I know you're a 30-year veteran, former police chief.
I got out of the Marines, did 4 years there, got out in 1960, joined the Suburban Police Department in Minneapolis. Minneapolis, you had to be 23 years old to be a police officer, and I was like 22 at the time. And so I worked in the suburb for a couple of years, and then I went to Minneapolis, went to the Tactical Squad there, did training. I was a defensive tactics instructor. And went back to school when the Cold War GI Bill came through. That was a big factor. And then also certain grant monies came through for police officers under the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration. So we got to be a whole cadre of both of us who were going to get our degrees at the university, and we formed a fraternity. It was, I think, for the National Fraternity of Lambda Alpha Epsilon. Police fraternity, and he came together and started to speak out about training and about things, and then some of the things that I'd written after I was a detective and I was in graduate school, and city manager suburb Minneapolis came and asked me if I wanted to be the chief of police in their town, and you have some new ideas about not wearing military uniforms and hiring college graduates. So that happened. I went there as a chief, and we set a policy of you had to have a 4-year college degree to be a police officer.
And what city was this?
It was Burnsville, Minnesota.
Burnsville.
They still have that requirement after about 40, 50 years now. And we wore non-military uniforms, blazers and slacks with department blazer patch. And
did I still do that today?
Yeah, well, I was there for about 4 years, and then I went fly down to Madison, Wisconsin, and I got the job there in 1972, and I stayed there as the chief for 21 years.
Okay.
In Madison. Integrated the department. We had one black officer when I took over the department. We had no women in uniform, though we had female youth officers that could not carry a weapon, and they had arrest powers. And they had to have a 4-year college degree. And they could not compete for promotion. Talk about a perfect storm ready to happen. So
right.
We brought women into the department all the time. It was very, my book, Arrested Development, talks a little bit about what that was like. A lot of people against my policies, and especially how I wanted to handle street demonstrations against the war and civil rights demonstrations that were quite frequent in our city, and we took a very soft approach that has since been proved to be the best way by some researchers in the UK in talking about handling football violence in Europe.
Right.
And so I was there for many years. The last 10 years of my 12 years of my career, ran into the works of Dr. W. Edwards Deming on quality improvement, and we became sort of forerunners in using the quality improvement method, flattening the organization, listening to officers of ideas, training supervisors to be what we call quality leaders, helping their officers grow and to thrive, and to listen to the good ideas that officers have. Then I retired in 1993. I generally 70 or something, and sort of have a revelation about where did I get all these ideas in about treating people and all that. Do I get those from where did that all come from? Did it come from the Constitution? And ended up feeling a call to Christian ministry. So
okay,
I went off to a seminar, went through that whole process for a few years, and ended up being ordained as a priest in the Episcopal Church, and I've served parishes in various capacities for the last 25 years. And wrote a book in 2012 called Arrested Development, how and why police need to improve the things they're doing, going over the obstacles of anti-intellectualism.
There's a lot of that.
discourtesy,
right.
Corruption,
right.
Those kinds of things.
Right.
And promote the book, I started writing a blog called Improving Police on WordPress. And that blog now has, in 78 years now, it's had a 500,000 hits on it.
Nice.
And about 1,500 people at one time followed that blog. And there's about, about 1,200 people. There's 1,500 posts. So I tell criminal justice students, if you want to write a paper, just get on a blog and give you some ideas.
Yeah.
Use a search engine.
Yeah, that's good.
So I kind of backed off. And, I'm going to be 82 now, so I'm really, I come out of that generation of the 60s and the 70s.
Mm.
Kind of got off talking about these things on a daily basis on Facebook and Twitter, and just kind of occasionally now post a piece on the blog. Still remains active. There's still people. I hope it's helpful. I hope it gives some officers who wonder sometimes if they're going crazy because they think policing should be done a different way, that there are different ways we can do this job, and somehow we've got to be able to think about that, to be able to think outside the box, and above all, to understand that we, as much as we put it on our cars, that we serve and protect, to really do that, to really really serve and really protect.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Talking about this whole militarization type of things, when I was reading your blog on WordPress, Improving Police, I noticed you wrote some key findings. I just want to read those, some of the key findings. Over 90% of citizens in the United States have at least one SWAT team present in their county of residence. 91% of SWAT call-ups are not for armed, barricaded persons, but in non-emergency warrants services, which often result in property being seized and damage to the property, as in door breaches. Cities instituting SWAT teams do not experience a reduction in crime or reduction in officer injuries, the primary reasons for their organization. The higher the percentage of African Americans in a given area, the more SWAT team deployments in those neighborhoods. 84% of the time, property is seized, and 70% of the events are forceful entries. Less than 1% of the time are shots fired or persons killed by SWAT teams. The result of this is a negative impact on trust and support of police, which is necessary for police effectiveness. Some very startling statistics, I think. 84% of the time property is seized, right? So they're going in there just kind of doing drug sweeps and things like that, taking guns or weapons. Yeah.
If you're a hammer, then all the world's a nail.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's shocking. I think it was something that I think there should be conversations with police and citizens about this. Is this what they want?
Well, I think. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, no, I'm just thinking this way. And then, of course, that begs a whole other problem about drug enforcement and
right.
how that's carried out. And now we've got, you know, states which have, they're right next to one another, and some across a bridge or a river, in which one side of the river, it's okay to toke up, and the other side of the river is that, you know, you're going to be hassled, maybe taken to jail.
Yeah, Massachusetts, one of Connecticut's border states, where I am is in Connecticut. Massachusetts just legalized marijuana. So we actually, the police officers in the state of Connecticut, you know, had to put something out saying, remember, it's illegal, because you had a lot of people going from Connecticut into Massachusetts buying their stuff. And then obviously they want to return home. So, yeah, you know, they had to put warnings out about that kind of stuff. So and I do totally agree that a lot of this has to do with this war on drugs and also this military industrial complex that we got going on, this overabundance of arms and weapons they had nothing better to do with. So let's just arm the police. You know, let's give it to our police forces.
Yeah.
It's just.
That's right. I mean, if we take a look at, I've had this puzzle since the early 70s and 60s, when the 90s were a large number of police fatalities, more than we have today, but nobody thinks of that. They think that today has got to be the worst for police, but
right.
It really isn't.
It really isn't. You're absolutely
but,
right.
It's in that case, police were being primarily shot by handguns. And so, here the problem is the handgun. How come we're not opposed to this? Why don't we take a stand on this? And, you know, I remember, a lot of officers belong to NRA and everything, and generally they get into the police department in the early days through firearms training and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But it was back in the, I think it was the 80s when the Teflon bullet came up, the body armor now there's a bullet out there that has a Teflon coating that can pierce police body armor.
Right.
And we asked the NRA that they would agree and support legislation, banning Teflon bullets, and they wouldn't do it. And I said, if you can stick with the NRA through that, cop killer bullets, they're gonna make sure that is not illegal. That's what's killing you. Why don't you speak up?
Right. Yeah.
Why don't you speak up?
As far as this whole military thing, in your opinion, why don't you think that more officers want to speak up? Why don't the legislatures do anything about it? I mean, this is all seems, we all seem to be in this cycle of legislatures not doing anything. We understand it's a problem. Numerous rights groups, former police officers, academics are saying this is a problem, the militarization of the police. Why can't we get anything done about this? Or what should be done about it? Or how can we go forward with this?
Well, one of the problems is, and I'll say it bluntly, is that all that weapon stuff's a lot of fun.
Yeah, well, that's true.
It's fun to go out the range, tactical stuff. It's fun to get all this kind of extra training and everything else and everything. But looking at the big picture, it's not what we ought to do. What we need to do is if we really were honest and sincere about community oriented policing, we would be asking the community these questions. Do you want us to buy an armored vehicle? We can get one. We can't. We're going to say that we can get it for free, but it's not, because we've got to pay two officers to go get this thing and drive it all the way back from some army proving ground someplace in the country. And we've got to have it painted and everything, so it's really not going to be a free gift. But anyway, how do you want us to use it? There are legitimate law enforcement reasons that we need to have an armored vehicle in an urban area or any place, because although there are armored weapons around here, if an officer or a citizen is injured, we need to get in there and help them. An armored vehicle is the best way to do that. Okay. Having said that, then let's construct some kind of policies in using this, and maybe even what color we're going to paint it and what it looks like. And are we going to use it on parades every time there's a public event? Is that how the police department is going to present itself? And when you have kids' day at the police department, are you going to open up your little tank here and have the little kids sit in it and say just how great the local police are? Because I see that all the time.
Yeah.
And I think the community, which has been the lesson in the past, because it's pretty hard to contact the police or to give them any input. I mean, it's tough to do that. But there needs to be some kind of dialogue, and it's going to have to be initiated by police. How do you want us to use this vehicle? How do you want us to use our SWAT team? How do you think we should be dressed? What do you think we should be doing? And in our use of the force, when do you think that they should be appropriate? And have that kind of discussion. But right now, I think that very few communities, have that kind of discussion.
I think you're right. I don't think that many communities are having that discussion. So therefore, it's going to be difficult to go forward.
And there's this attitude. And too, it's, here's the situation. We're the police and you're not. now let's talk, sure.
Yeah. And as long as they have the backing of the legislatures, like I said, as long as the police unions are standing behind and or endorsing many of their legislatures, then no change is going to happen.
Yeah. We talked about the power of the police union in this dialogue, too, which is tremendous. And it has to do with the tenure of the police chief and the relationship of the mayor and appointed police chiefs and the lack of tenure. And it's all mixed up in this. And why don't police speak up? Well, because it's pretty hard to get the sanction of your fellow officers.
Right.
So, let's not talk about these things. Are you one of us or not? And nobody wants to be an outsider, because in policing, an outsider can lead you to your personal safety.
Yeah, which is
officers don't like you talking. And I think that's one of the reasons we don't hear more discussion from women officers about what's going on in their departments, with officers of color and how they are feeling being discriminated within their department, because to do so, to go against the system, to go against the culture here, could be hazardous to your health.
Yes. Which is terrifying when you really think about it. I mean, and I've heard some stories about some places, which is really disappointing and really terrifying. And I'm sure that the community does not want to know or is not aware of that kind of situation.
Sure.
I certainly appreciate it. Thank you very much. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it. Thank you for your service as well.
Press on. Officers like you who come out and I'm really happy that you're still engaged in trying to improve the field, because I see a lot of my fellow officers, I sort of expected they were bright leaders, and then when they retired, they sort of, they like to go to the police golf outing and the retired officers group, and if they've been speaking out, somehow they're not welcomed anymore.
No, I certainly can understand that. I plan on doing this. I mean, I'm trying to, as the focus of my podcast is to bring the community and the officers together. So I think that I can say this, I think with pretty much a sense of boldness, is that if anyone who's really not for my message, then, we weren't friends. I'm trying to make the police department better. I'm trying to work with the community. I'm not trying to say all police officers are bad. I'm not trying to say that. But there's always room for improvement, and I want officers to really work with the community and not be seen as an occupying force and not be seen as a negative. People should not be terrified when they get pulled over by the police. Hearts should not be beating fast. Interactions with the police should be a positive thing, and so many times they're not. And so how do we work on this? How do we get through that? And that's what I'm focused on.
You're on the right track, that's for sure.
Yeah. So thank you so much, Chief Cooper.
It was great talking with you, Captain. Appreciate it.
No, thank you, Chief Cooper. Okay, take care. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye. I hope you guys really enjoyed that interview. Thank you so much to Chief David C. Cooper. Your time and your wisdom is greatly appreciated. Thank you for blazing the trail and taking us towards a path of more empathetic policing, towards getting the community and the police officers to work together. Thank you so much for blazing that trail. Thank you so much for your time and for your energy today. It's truly greatly appreciated. So during the interview, Chief Cooper mentioned a book called Justice Without Trials by Jerome H. Skolnick. So guys might want to check that book out. I certainly am. Anything that Chief Cooper says I ought to check out, I'm certainly going to check out. So I'm going to take a look into that. I never heard of the book before. So it's called Justice Without Trial, Law Enforcement in Democratic Society. Jerome H. Skolnick. It is available on Amazon and I assume other platforms as well. Make sure you check out Chief Cooper's book, Arrested Development. Check out his blog, Improving Police. Make sure you guys hit me up on Twitter, CPTL Hunter. My email is hunterpoliceconsulting@gmail.com. Instagram, CPTL Hunter. I'm also on Facebook, Lawrence Hunter, hunterpolicetraining.com, hunterpolicetraining.com. So hit me up. Let me know what you think. Let me know what you like, what you don't like, and how I can improve and how we can improve the police together. So that's it, ladies and gentlemen. Until next episode, guys, take care. Much love and peace.